good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the...
We have to join the community of people who are struggling against corporate exploitation, against racism, militarism, speciesism, sexism, homophobia, against all of the forms of exploitation and discrimination, against every mode of hierarchy that exists on this planet. And we have to take them all down. We have to take apart the mechanisms of capitalism and build new ways of organizing ourselves in society and new ways of relating to the natural world as a whole.
Good horse amongst the rich ones, how oft times we go there, an unwelcome guest.
You're listening to episode 546 of Unwelcome Guests, How the Environmental Movement Died of Success, and What to Do About It. I'm Robin Upton. And that was the voice of Steve Best, professor and spokesman for the Animal Liberation Front and the Earth Liberation Front. And he gives us the history of increasing frustration for people tackling what they term speciesism, that unflattering human habit of seeing the world as something only for their benefit. Now, in this interview, he mentions how the idea of animal welfare became the idea of animal liberation, giving animals rights, and then became more militant forms, direct action, which he says befit the dire situation in which the Earth finds itself. And although he's talking about tackling speciesism, I think a lot of what he says can be extended to all aspects of defending the Earth, defending what is good against corporate plunder, against self-interested psychopathic domination and destruction. Now, this is, if you like, the show in reverse. This is What to Do About It first. In our second hour, we'll be hearing a talk from John Stauber, who's been a regular on the show. He'll be recounting how the environmental movement died, which is an aspect that Steve Best doesn't bring out, how its very success and popularity meant that the corporations which it was opposed to decided, okay, let's not fight this one, let's buy them off, and effectively neutered their potential by offering to fund and support, that's in a euphemistic sense, their cause. Now, as we heard in episode 543, the power of money to corrupt, when organizations and when people are motivated by money, then that tends to dominate, and their original passion, their original motives and ideals become subordinated. And as John Stauber suggests, this is what happened to the environmental movement. Now, this is an interview from June 2006 with Steve Best, and it starts by discussing his book Igniting a Revolution, Voices in Defense of Mother Earth.
I'm just wondering if you can talk about this book, like what were the main things you wanted to contribute by putting this book together, and what do you think are some of the most important things within it to offer now?
Sure. So the second effort I did with Tony Nocella, and pretty much set on the same model as our first book, Arrows for Freedom Fighters. It was the first real study, I think, of the Animal Liberation Front and Animal Liberation Tactics. And what we tried to do in both books is to look at a variety of voices and perspectives on radical ideas and put people together that ordinarily don't come together and actually try to build some bridges amongst different communities. So, for instance, in both books, you'll find essays by political prisoners, radical academics, ecofeminists, black liberationists, Native Americans, and so on. So the books are meant not just to study history, but to actually help make it and to contribute to what we think is an important element of radical politics today, and that is the project of bridge building, forming alliances, and the like. So that same model we pretty much followed in the new book, Igniting a Revolution, Voices in Defense of the Earth. But that latter book is proved to be even a bigger project. We have, I think, instead of 20 contributors, over 40 contributors. And we pretty much rounded up everybody that we could think of. And we also have poets in the book who begin every section with a political poem, which is a nice way to start off. And the sections are divided into different types of analyses and issues, like critiques of direct action, or analyses of direct action, relationships between environmentalism and race issues, the history of radical environmentalism. And on that point, I think there's some really good things in the essay about the history of Earth First and the Earth Liberation Front and direct action tactics for the environment as they evolved in England and the United States and spread throughout the world. So it's really quite a big book. I think it reads very well. All the essays are very clear. And it gives some new insights, I think, into what radical environmentalism is. I should say really revolutionary environmentalism, because that's the term that we use. And we try to distinguish that from radical environmentalism. There's been a whole host of radical theories that have been called that. And I think it's a difference, distinction with a difference to talk about this as revolutionary environmentalism, because we're trying to map out a new approach that looks at the defense of the Earth literally by any means necessary, and so that all options for defense of the Earth are on the table now, all tactics, because we live in an era of advanced ecocide. This is an era of global warming. This is the sixth greatest extinction crisis on the planet. India and China are awakening giants who are moving toward huge consumer empires, themselves becoming fast food nations and automobile nations. And the problems that we face on this earth now are just staggering. And as we say in the book, there's really no time left now for further studies and analyses and debates and dialogues. I don't think there's much time left for the long march to the institutions. The planet is in a grave crisis right now, and we need actions that are appropriate to the level of the emergency situation that we see to exist on this planet. So revolutionary environmentalism, therefore, will include any and all struggles to a fight against oppressors and exploiters of the earth. And so therefore you'll find in some areas of the world, in South America and elsewhere, that people are engaged in armed struggle against the giant oil companies, against people trying to destroy their villages, their way of life, their natural environment.
Mm-hmm. You wrote in an article, like, considering all these crises we have, you know, why is there not a revolution in this country right now, and why are people cruising the malls rather than rioting in the streets? And are Americans like the good Germans who went about their business in the midst of the Nazi genocide? And what are your thoughts on that? Like, why do you think people are so? I mean, why do you think that radical things that are called radical, that are called necessary in other countries, are called radical here? You know, and why are people so? I mean, what, you know what I mean by that?
Yeah, it's just amazing the fact that in the U.S. there is hardly any opposition to the most criminal, corrupt, and fascist administration that we've ever had, arguably. It's just amazing that people are carrying on their lives as if everything is normal. And part of it is the long-standing problems of the depoliticization of the citizenry here, that people are controlled by the propaganda of mass media, where mass media is basically a tool of the state. They're shaped and distracted by the spectacles of the mass entertainment society, what I call culture dope, the kind of televised or digitized narcotics that serves the purpose of SOMA to keep them happy and distracted from the real issues of the day. But it's also the fact that in the post 9/11 climate, people are still very afraid of so-called terrorists, not understanding that the most dangerous terrorist is the one they're looking to protect them. Of course, I'm talking about George Bush. And some of the recent polls here in the United States have shown that people are largely not concerned with the fact that Bush has violated the Constitution, violated his the law in terms of his responsibilities to Congress to let them know when he's doing things like illegal eavesdropping on the American public and to get permission for that kind of action. They're okay with that because they are quite willing to trade their liberties for what they think is security. And, of course, we don't have either here. And as Benjamin Franklin said some time back, those who give up their liberty for security deserve neither. And that's what we have here in the United States right now. We don't have liberty or security. But I think, you know, people are really looking to Father Bush for the security, the kind of security he can't provide because, of course, he's just aggravating the problem of terrorism, not reducing it. And another situation here is that I think people are afraid to get politically involved today. Issues like the Shaq 7 trial show that even legal, constitutionally protected forms of dissent can earn you the charge of eco-terrorism, can earn you swarm of FBI paparazzi who are documenting your activities as if holding a sign in protest is a crime. Seems to be these days in the U.S. So there are a lot of reasons for that, but from the Democratic Party to the populace at large to certainly the so-called left, there's no opposition to Bush and the war and the biological meltdown that we see on the planet today. It just amazes me.
Yeah. Can you talk a bit about what's known as the Green Scare, like you mentioned the Shaq 7, just to let listeners know what's going on with that? I've talked about it a bunch on my show, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on what this says about the priorities and also the fears of those in power.
Yeah, the Green Scare is something I started talking about many years ago, and the term is catching on, finally. It, of course, is meant to suggest that the times that we are living in right now, in the first decade of the 21st century, are very much, unfortunately, like the 50 years ago in the U.S., the era of the 1950s when Senator Joseph McCarthy and the House Un-American Activity Committees prevailed, and there was a massive persecution in the U.S. against any form of dissent, any kind of activism, or even liberal values were demonized as a communist, where if you were seen at a party where so-called communists were, your picture was taken, and you were called to the U.S. Court system to account for yourself and pressure to name names. And, of course, it was an absolutely chilling time in American history. People lost their jobs. People suicided out of despair. People were afraid to show any kind of a dissent whatsoever. And ultimately that caved in, and the 1960s appeared for just a little fresh breath of liberation there. But that was annihilated fairly quickly, too. But now we have not the Red Scare, where the fear is of communism, and we have to fear communists taking over our country from domestic cells, but animal rights and environmental activism. So it's called the Green Scare because the real threat to society today, according to the corporate state complex, are animal rights and environmental activists. And it's worth noting that, in fact, these groups, environmentalists and animal rights activists, are the most dynamic political forces in the country today and in other countries such as England, because the social movements seem to have gone far, far into retreat. The only kind of real activity we've seen along that front has been, in the U.S. at least, has been with the anti-immigration struggles. And we had millions of people in the streets for a week or two in L.A. and Chicago and other places. But that's kind of died down, and I'm not sure that will actually become a serious justice movement. But apart from that, the real action is coming from animal rights and environmentalists. So they are a threat to the corporate state complex, and the corporate state complex understands that. So they have targeted them, and the best way that they can do that is by calling them not communists, because that threat is historically obsolete, but terrorists, and eco-terrorists specifically. And therefore, once they've been labeled accordingly, the corporate state complex can create new laws and bring the whole legal apparatus of terrorism and eco-terrorism down upon these activists in a crushing way. So that's what we see today, the Green Scare, where we're supposed to believe that these people pose a threat to domestic security. This, of course, is ironic given the fact that we have militiamen, neo-fascists, Aryan nations, possibly super so-called super gangs coming over from the Mexican border that could have members of Al-Qaeda or very hostile anti-American forces coming over, all of which are far more dangerous than animal and earth liberation activists. But we're supposed to believe that these are the greatest threats to American security. Well, they're the greatest threats to corporations. And that's why they've been demonized, and that's why we have a Green Scare right now.
Mm-hmm. To put some things in a bit of local context, in Guelph here, where the city I'm in the past year there have been a handful of acts of sabotage claimed by the Earth Liberation Front and more that weren't claimed by them. And obviously you aren't involved in this kind of stuff yourself, but would you mind explaining some of the rationale behind this growing phenomenon of people who are working outside of the law to cause economic damage?
Yeah, there's a logic to radicalism, and that is that new and more militant approaches will always be developed according to their need, according to the realization that existing tactics, strategies, philosophies are limited and are inappropriate for the level of destruction and violence that is being directed against this Earth and all of its species. So you can trace a dynamic, for instance, in both the animal and environmental movements, from welfarism to rights to liberation, and from mainstream tactics to underground tactics, direct action, and forms of sabotage. So, for instance, the welfare approach in the animal rights or in the animal advocacy history and movement proved to be totally inadequate, because you could basically do anything to an animal and still say that somehow you were protecting its welfare. And it was realized, certainly by the 1970s, that welfarism was a completely inadequate form of protection for the interests of animals, and that they need rights, that they have rights. These rights need to be protected. So an animal rights movement emerged that was something a form of radical, at least philosophically. But politically, the animal rights movement used the same tactics as the animal welfare movement. These tactics were based on education and legislation. It was thought that by educating people and by passing new laws to try to promote animal rights, we could win this struggle for justice for animals. But it soon became apparent that the state is a completely corrupt entity, and that corporate interests, not justice, dominate Congress and political structures in general, and that other forms, other tactics are needed to truly protect the interests of animals. And so if we can't rely on the state to defend the interests of animals, and we have to take that upon themselves. If the state is in bed with corporations, then we have to attack the corporations. And so economic sabotage was used as a way to undermine their ability to exploit animals in one of the most effective ways possible, and that is by attacking their profit motive, attacking their bottom line. And in many cases, this has worked, because a lot of animal exploiters are vulnerable to these kind of attacks, and they have been put out of business. You can see the same kind of dynamic in the environmental movement. You can see a dynamic from mainstream environmentalism in the 1970s to Earth First, which emerged in the U.S. in 1980. And Dave Foreman, one of the co-founders of Earth First, by the way, worked first as a mainstream lobbyist for the environment. And so he had an insider's view of how corrupt the political process was, and he realized that we could never protect the environment from a lobbying standpoint by trying to play the game of the politicians and the corporate money changers. And so he realized that we need to start a direct action movement that was called Earth First, and at least initially in its history, use economic sabotage and tactics of property destruction. But in England in the early 1990s, it was realized that even Earth First was too conservative, and we needed more powerful weapons of destruction, such as arson. And so the Earth Liberation Front emerged as a faction out of Earth First, and that thereafter spread throughout Europe and into the United States. So you see there's kind of a progression of radicalism, where it's realized that each existing form is inadequate, has its limitations, and something more radical is needed. And so we can only imagine that at some point the tactics of, say, the Animal Liberation Front might prove far too conservative, far too limited, and that maybe what we really need is armed struggle to protect the interests of animals, and maybe someday the struggle will evolve to that level, as it has with so many human rights struggles, human justice struggles have been fought from the barrel of a gun. It may happen with animal liberation too. So who can predict the future, but it seems to be one of increasing radicalism.
Yeah, many people seem to express reluctance to even think about that idea or talk about it, but in the book Igniting Revolution, I mean, a lot of people talk about, like, the abolition of slavery, for example, and many other different movements which are championed now, which did involve armed struggle and all kinds of things which would be considered radical by those who are benefiting from the continuation of such things, you know?
Yeah.
So, I'm glad to see, it's a very kind of comprehensive discussion going on in this book, and I'm really glad you're bringing it up.
Yeah, I mean, all tactics are on the table. All tactics have to be discussed. When Malcolm X said by any means necessary, he meant using violence strictly as a means of self-defense. When radical or revolutionary environmentalists are using the term by any means necessary, they're also speaking now of using it not just in self-defense of themselves, but in self-defense of the earth, right? So it's interesting that all of the justifications that Bush uses to invade Iraq, or that people use to defend violence in general, a lot of them come down to self-defense. If we're talking about the defense of animals, what I call extensional self-defense, because they can't defend themselves, we need to defend their interests for them, their lives for them. And who's going to defend the earth? Well, we're defending the earth. This is, in effect, a kind of self-defense of the earth, then violence makes, whether or not it's tactically wise, it's justified according to the same kind of arguments used to justify violence in the human world. Use the same kind of arguments used by Bush. People shouldn't be shocked when some people talk about using violence to defend animals or to defend the earth. This is a violent world. This is a violent society. Corporate and political leaders use and talk about violence all the time. So when it's done in these movements, really it's just using the same kind of arguments that they use in extended ways.
And there's a big big dichotomy or divide, I wonder if you can talk a bit about, between people who strictly adhere to legal tactics and will condemn those in public who choose not to. And I know that's off. Even though people in the government seem to think that mainstream groups are, you know, supporting and funneling money to underground groups, there's still this large divide. And I wonder if you see any progress in that or any hope in that.
Not really. And part of the purpose of Terrorists or Freedom Fighters, for instance, was to try to heal that divide within the U.S. animal advocacy movement, because really, one of the biggest divides in that movement is between those who support direct action and those who don't. What I call the legalists and the pluralists. I said earlier that the welfare approach and the rights approach really have more in common than they are different. People like Gary Francione, animal rights philosophers, make this big deal about how incommensurate, how radically different the rights approach is to the welfare approach. Well, maybe philosophically, but politically, no, because they use the same tactics of legislation and education, because they're both legalists in the sense that they seek legal means of change, and they think that's adequate. But the direct action, the Animal Liberation Front, the Shack Movement, and other tendencies, realize that we cannot win liberation for the animals only through the political process, and we have to use harassment, sabotage, or whatever tactics are necessary to fight animal exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I call pluralists. And I call them pluralists because they're not saying we don't need welfare approaches, we don't need rights approaches, we don't need education and legislation. Of course we need that. We need all that. We need all approaches. But we also need direct action. And so whereas the welfare and rights people will criticize the direct action people, typically from a complete ignorance of their philosophies and the history of these tactics throughout modern history, throughout all democratic struggles, throughout all rights struggles, the direct action camp is far more pluralistic, recognizing the need for all tactics, including theirs. Now, I wrote a critique against the Humane Society of the United States a while back when they made just a simply outrageous statement that shows you what kind of problems we're facing here from the legalist camp against direct action. And they've often been critical of the ALF and the press. And you know, nobody really appreciated that because ALF doesn't need more criticism from the mainstream than it gets, and it doesn't help anyone's cause. But at one point, there was a remark by a guy named Mike Markarian in HSUS, and he said that we are not terrorists. The ALF and those tendencies are. We applaud the FBI for going after them. Now, that actually is encouraging the state to crush a vital element of the animal advocacy movement. And when you applaud the FBI for going after direct actionists and people who engage in illegal tactics and sabotage, you have to realize what that means. You have to realize you're applauding the FBI breaking into homes, taking people by force to grand juries, throwing them in jail, harassing their friends and their families, separating them from their animals, creating a witch hunt. You have to realize that you are supporting what I call neo-McCarthyism. And that was so outrageous a remark that I felt it was necessary to finally take the gloves off and take HSUS to task for that kind of remark. So that shows you we have a long way to go before there's really solidarity and understanding amongst all the different elements within the animal advocacy movement here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. There's something else I'd like to talk about. Like you're talking a lot about direct action, the things that, well, maybe you know, from a simply moral perspective, not considered wrong, but certainly by the laws created are illegal, and it's you know, it's inevitable to expect that some people will go to jail or be killed for certain things. And you wrote a good article about prisoner support, and I wonder if you can maybe talk a bit about like things learned from the experience of the Shack 7 and the Green Scare, things like prisoner support and the importance of that, and the connections between people who are in prison and people who aren't in prison.
Yeah, well, the people who aren't in prison are privileged in comparison to those who are in prison. And those who are in prison are there because they've taken extraordinary measures in defense of animals of the earth. And that ought to be appreciated, acknowledged, and supported. So when even if we don't support their tactics, we need to support them. Because I can't think of what must be a lonelier experience than being sent away to jail and not being appreciated by your colleagues or your comrades, or being forgotten by your comrades, and not getting enough mail, not getting enough books, not getting enough support, not getting all the things that you need in prison. So those activists who are in prison, and you can see a good list of them in magazines like No Compromise, they really need our support economically, but perhaps most important morally. They need us to send books to them. They need our letters. They need us to defend them. to be there for them. And they themselves say that's about the most important thing you can do, is just don't forget them while they're there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And a couple more things I'd like to talk about. You talked a lot about building bridges, and that's one of the main things I've noticed in the book Igniting a Revolution, is that there's such a wide, you know, environmentalism has normally been viewed as, you know, by like white middle-class people, patting themselves in the back in a lot of ways and not really challenging things, but this book certainly takes that to task with Black Panthers and the Native Youth Movement and eco-feminists and guerrilla warriors and all kinds of stuff. I wonder if you can talk about some of, I'm curious to see what insights you have into bridges that are being built right now and what kind of hope we can look for the future for different alliances to be built and creating more of a revolutionary movement out of this.
Yeah, I think that's an important and groundbreaking aspect of the book, that you can read essays by ecofeminists, Black liberationists, multiracialists, Native Americans, and many more different types of people. And they're all talking about the same thing, the need to defend radical struggles, the need to defend one another, the need to defend the earth. And so, for instance, you can look at the essay by a Black liberationist in the book, where he talks about the political education that he received thanks to his coming to animal rights lectures or conferences and speaking at them and gradually learning what animal liberation was about, and saying that he had a lot to learn about overcoming some of his sexist tendencies, and he got a political education by doing that. And he also learned a lot about overcoming some of his speciesism, and that helped him to grow and evolve morally and politically. And the book itself, therefore, is building bridges amongst different groups and different figures, and we need to try to come together and understand that really we're fighting the same battle. We have the same enemy. And if you want this enemy, I would call transnational capitalism, corporate state complex. It's the capitalist machine, I think, that is affecting the interest of all peoples and all species and the entire earth. That's something that we can fight together. So in the past, there hasn't been any strong alliances amongst the different aspects of environmentalism. Environmentalism has always been seen, rightly so, as an elitist, white, privileged movement. And to understand that and the problems of the environmental movement, such that I think and hope are changing now, as opposed to a multi-class, multi-race, multi-alliance type of formation. Problems with the environmental movement were evident in the 19th century. In the U.S., environmentalism emerged with the romantics, such as Thoreau and Emerson, and with a lot of amateur environmentalists, people that were hunters or fishermen, people who are men of leisure. And these people had very privileged positions in the world, and they were able to enjoy the environment, and they were able to recognize that it was being destroyed by industrialization and modernization in the 19th century. And so they sought to protect it, and that was their enduring legacy. It was very important. But they had also internalized the basic ideologies of the day. They were often sexist and racist, and they surely were often elitist in the sense that their understanding of the environment was only that of a natural environment, but not a social environment. At the same time that they were defending the natural environment, people in the urban centers of cities like Chicago were suffering intense forms of pollution and poisoning, and their environment was completely degraded and corrupting. It was deadly. But no mention was made of that. And so they had a very narrow definition of the environment. It was elitist. The people who were suffering in the urban environment hardly had the opportunity to care about or enjoy the kinds of natural vistas that people like John Muir were so intent upon protecting. And again, to protect those was very important. But that struggle was not broadened to include contact with the poor, with women, the plight of people of color, with the disadvantage, as they were all suffering in urban centers and elsewhere. And that first wave of environmentalism that emerged in the 19th century, the same problems with that were replicated in the second wave, and that would be the mainstream environmental movement that began in the late 1960s and developed throughout the 1970s, the so-called environmental decade, decade of environmentalism in the U.S. That movement, too, unlike in the 19th century, which was largely a movement of amateurs, it was a professional movement. Rooted in the work of professional politicians and the MBAs and accountants who are running their organizations, the huge environmental organizations that emerged and entrenched themselves in Washington. But these environmentalists were white, they were middle class, they were privileged, and they made no attempt to connect to or to understand the struggles of women and people of color and the poor. And so they were elitist, just like the first wave environmentalism was. And you really see that when people have this idea of the environmental movement as privilege, as white, there's a whole history of this, and it's not just a stereotype. It's not an unjustified view. In fact, in the late 1960s, many of the progressives in the U.S., many of the civil rights and anti-war protesters and movements, they rejected environmentalism as a white middle-class bourgeois concern that was a little narrow, but they thought it was distracting from their more important focuses on civil rights and stopping the war. Well, now we see that all these issues are connected, and all these things are coming together. And in the book, in the introduction to Igniting a Revolution, we lay out a third wave of the environmental movement as it emerged in the U.S. and elsewhere. And that occurred in response to the second wave, in response to the limitations of this mainstream environmental movement, when all kinds of different tendencies started appearing in the 1970s and have proliferated ever since. These include ecofeminism, ecoprimitivism, direct action tactics, beginning with the Animal Liberation Front, Paul Watson and the Sea Shepherd Society, Earth First, and then their Earth Liberation Front, and grassroots movements spawning throughout the U.S. where people in neighborhoods were fighting corporate powers that were polluting their environments, and they were having they were going directly after corporations in a way the mainstream could or would not. And importantly, the so-called environmental justice movement, which emerged in the 1990s, which was based upon connections between environmentalism and people of color, where it was recognized that corporate polluters were targeting people of color, the communities of people of color, because they were disenfranchised and they were poor. And they were setting up shop there to produce and to dump their various deadly toxic pollutants. And people of color mobilized against that. And suddenly it was clear that the issues of race and class and environment were connected, fundamentally connected. And no more, such as in the 1960s, where people of color saying, hey, this environmental movement is just white privilege, has nothing to do with us. So three waves of environmentalism emerged in the U.S. And in this third wave, it's characterized, amongst other things, by coalition building. By people recognizing the connections that different groups have, how environmental issues affect the interests of all. And one of the things that we call for in Igniting Revolution is a new concept of total revolution, total liberation, recognizing that human liberation, animal liberation, and earth liberation are interconnected movements, and we can't have one without having the other two. So we really need to be thinking in a systemic way. We need to grasp the big picture. We need to see how we're all affected by the same forces and dynamics. And we need to see that together we are much stronger than we are apart. And if we can build a new environmental movement that engages issues of race and class, for instance, can you imagine how powerful this movement could be as opposed to a movement that is strictly white, strictly privileged, strictly northern, and strictly Western in its mentality and its composition.
Yeah, absolutely. So much potential there. So much potential. Maybe to finish off, we got, you know, a bit less than 10 minutes. So wonder if you can comment on a quote that you quoted by Edmund Burke, saying that all that is necessary for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing. And you're right as well that it's not enough to not do harm, but we have to actively work to bring about the good, which means struggling against forces that oppress and destroy. I wonder if you can maybe leave some listeners with your thoughts on that comment there.
Yeah, it's not enough to be opposed to things. I mean, how many times have you heard people say, oh, I hate racism. I'm so opposed to what corporations do to the environment. It just makes me sick to see what happens to the animals. Well, that's not enough. Your sentiments are fine, but they mean nothing unless they're put into action. And to have those sentiments is part of what it is to be a good person. But as Burke pointed out, all that evil needs is for good people simply to have those thoughts and to not put those thoughts into action. All that evil needs to do is triumph, is to just face a situation where, as he said, good men do nothing. So we must do something. It's not enough just to be good in your heart or good in your thoughts or good in your intentions. You have to be good in your actions, too. And we have to become actively involved in these struggles. It's not enough to be vegan, although that is the most profound step toward earth, animal, and human liberation that any person could undertake in their lives. We have to become part of a social movement. We have to struggle for the greater liberation movements that are unfolding on this planet right now. And so I'm hoping that people will see that it's not enough to just put your own house in order, although that's certainly an important and necessary step to anything. We have to join the world house, to borrow King's phrase. We have to join the community of people who are struggling against corporate exploitation, against racism, militarism, speciesism, sexism, homophobia, against all of the forms of exploitation and discrimination, against every mode of hierarchy that exists on this planet. And we have to take them all down. We have to begin to build new democratic communities that can become democratic movements. We have to lead the way toward a social transformation that piece by piece, part by part, plank by plank, we can build new institutions, new ways of lives, new ways of living, and new worldviews, new sensibilities, new values, new ethics. And we can build these worlds right now in our lives and in our communities, but we have to institutionalize these and take apart the mechanisms of capitalism and build new ways of organizing ourselves in society and new ways of relating to the natural world as a whole.
Yeah, thank you very much, Steve. I think that's about it.
My pleasure.
Yeah, do you want to talk a bit about some ways people can learn more about the work you're doing?
Just go to my website by typing in drstevebest.org, drstevebest.org, and you'll see my website. You can find there links to my various books, and a lot of my articles are posted online. And you can find the introduction and table of contents to the new book, Igniting the Revolution, that I edited with Tony Nasella, and it's out on AK Press. And you can buy the book off the website of AK Press. And I really hope that people will buy and read it. It's not just another anthology. I think it's quite unique. I think it's an important book. It's not my book. It's a book of everyone who wrote it. It's a book really for the movement. It's the book to get us talking about what tactics we need for today, what kinds of alliances we need to form. It's a book for everyone. It's a book for the future.
I dreamed I saw Judy Berry last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Judy, you're 1 year dead. I never died, says she. I never died, says she. In Oakland, Judy, by God, says I, her standing by my bed. They maimed you with a pipe bomb, says Judy, but I ain't dead. Says Judy, but I ain't dead. The timber bosses killed you, Judy. They bombed you, Judy, says I. Takes more than bombs to kill a woman, says Judy, I didn't die. Says Judy, I didn't die. by. And standing there, as big as life, and smiling with her eyes, says Judy, what they forgot to kill went on to organize, went on to organize. From Garberville up to Maine, in every logging town where folks stand up to corporate green, their Judy can be found. Their Judy can be found. I dreamed I saw Judy Berry last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Judy, you're 1 year dead. I never died, says she. I never died, says she.
That was, of course, David Rovics, and I dare say many of you are familiar with the story of the late, great Judy Barry and her efforts to defend the forest by any means necessary. And the bomb referred to in the song was, I think the FBI eventually admitted, one that although they blamed her, it was in fact one that they themselves planted in an effort to oppose her advocacy of direct action to protect the forests. Now that story featured on an earlier episode of Unwelcome Guests, so if you'd like to track that down, you just go to the speakers section on our website, unwelcomeguests.net, and click on Judy Barry, and then you'll find all the shows in which she contributed. Now we're going to hear from John Stauber, and he's speaking at the 20th National Conference of the National Coalition Against the Misuse of Pesticides. This is from 2002. Now, I found this a helpful talk in understanding the mechanisms by which dissent is stifled. Why is it that window dressing aplenty, serious reform of the system is never contemplated by these large corporate structured environmental organizations?
I'm with Californians for Pesticide Reform, and it is my pleasure to be here tonight to introduce John Stauber. I think John is a boon to our movement because he's an investigative reporter who writes about lies. They're lies that hurt us. He gives us information and perspective about our corporate adversaries, and he does it with a sense of humor, although I think most of the time when we laugh about it, it's nervous laughter. When I asked him how he wanted to be introduced, he very simply said, well, there's two things. One, I'm the founder of the Center for Media and Democracy in Madison, Wisconsin, which works on information, media, and the public and the relation between those things. And he's the co-author of three books. Toxic Sludge is Good for You, a founder type of book, which gave us the well-known hierarchy of lies. There are lies, damn lies, and public relations. Mad Cow USA, which is about the masters of cover-up and probably make you never want to eat meat again, which is probably not a bad thing. And now you can buy this in the bookstore, and I'm sure John will sign it for you. Trust Us, We're Experts. This is about third-party expertise, the cult of expertise, and corporate propaganda. But as John said to me earlier today, propaganda isn't propaganda anymore if it's exposed. And although it's hard to keep up with the propagandist, he's trying on our behalf to expose it all. Tonight, John's going to talk to us about the corporate strategies of lies, damn lies, and public relations, and how they're poisoning our work and what we can do about it. I'm very proud to introduce John Stauber.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank the folks from Beyond Pesticides and National Coalition Against the Misuse of Pesticides for inviting me to be here at what I understand is the 20th National Conference. And I have to say right at the beginning that we're going to be circulating through the audience a sign-up sheet. For the last 8 years, Sheldon Rampton and I have been reporting on corporate and government propaganda, And it's always been frustrating to us because we've written our books and we've written our quarterly PR watch, but this stuff happens in real time. And now, over the past year, we've been able to soup up our website at www.prwatch.org with a feature called Spin of the Day. And we're actually able to report on real time in propaganda campaigns. And as much as I'm critical of the mainstream press for failing to investigate and reveal corporate and government propaganda campaigns, there is some great stuff out there. Occasionally, the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, sometimes weekly papers, sometimes websites like commondreams.org. And when we find something, and we usually put up more than one story a day, we post it. And then once a week, we email the bundled collection of the previous week's spins. So if you'd like to receive that once a week emailing, sign the sheet. If you put down your mailing address, we'll also send you a copy of PR Watch and try to guilt trip you into subscribing. But we do not market the list at all. I feel a little bit like, and I hope I don't get too maudlin and start to cry. Sometimes it happens. But I feel a little bit tonight like I'm really coming home. You know, when I heard that this was the 20th conference, I thought, man, that's a long time. And then I looked back over my own activist career, which began in high school. I graduated from high school in 71. And when I came out of high school, I was so convinced the apocalypse was around the corner. You know, after organizing Earth Day, we shut down our high school in Mel Laird's hometown of Marshfield, Wisconsin, and forced the administration to let us put on a teach-in in April of 1970, and we were organizing against the war in Vietnam, and it just looked hopeless. So I came out of high school only wanting to do two things. One was just move up to northern Wisconsin, get a little piece of land up in the Schwamigan National Forest, grow an organic garden, does this sound familiar, and, you know, live a sane and simple life a la Helen and Scott Nearing. And I thought, you know, that was really the best thing to do because this whole ugly scene's coming down in 5 years anyway, and, you know, this is what I want to do. Well, a couple years went by, and, you know, nothing really happened. And then by 1973, I realized the activist in me needed to come out. And in my life and my work, I really believe in serendipity or whatever you want to call it. My shamanic friends have different terms for it. But I, in 1974, had the good fortune of finding out two things. One was the bad news that the U.S. Forest Service for the last decade had been aerially spraying Agent Orange herbicides in the Schwamigan National Forest in the Lake Superior Basin, and of course not really bothering to tell anyone, but people eventually found out and that came out. The other bit of news was that this incredible woman existed in Globe, Arizona, by the name of Billy Shewcraft. How many people here have ever heard of Billy Shewcraft? Yeah, it's really amazing. There's like a couple dozen hands up. One thing that we absolutely have to do in our movement is learn about Billy Shewcraft. And today when I was browsing the books here, I was so happy to find, and this is going to be like the moldy oldie goldies tonight, but this incredible book that has sat on my shelf now for almost 20 years, A Bitter Fog, Herbicides and Human Rights by Carol Van Strom. Carol's an incredible writer. I read her coverage of the herbicide issue as it was happening in Whole Earth Review, and this book is absolutely fantastic, and it's like a lot of books. You know, you start out with a little pile, and now I've got an entire wall of books piled up over the last 30 years of must-read books I haven't gotten to yet. So this was one book that I was able to get to today, and I was so happy to see Billy Shewcraft mentioned, because Billy Shewcraft is one of the most important people in our movement. Billy Shewcraft, back in 1969, stepped out of her trailer home outside the Tonto National Forest in Globe, Arizona, and as she was stepping out in her nightgown early in the morning to enjoy a beautiful morning, overhead came a Bureau of Land Management spray helicopter with its spray jets stuck open. And she was absolutely saturated with a combination of 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T. I think it was what at the time they called Silvex. It's basically an Agent Orange formulation, tremendously contaminated with dioxin. And Billy Shewcraft immediately noticed that the animals were getting sick, the people were getting sick. And she was just a plain-spoken poetess, very much a Western person, a fan of Barry Goldwater. And she just decided, this stops here. And she investigated the issue. And really, we owe it to Billy Shewcraft that the American public was woken up to the dangers of the 5 million acres a year back then sprayed with these phenoxy herbicides. And yet Billy herself died of cancer in 1976. Her organs filled with phenoxy herbicides. And many years later, Dow Chemical actually settled out of court with her family. And there was a gag order placed on that settlement, which was one reason why a lot of people haven't heard of Billy. So Billy is a true hero and a true heroine, and we really need, I think, more than ever to learn from Billy. By the way, one problem with my talk tonight is that I'm slotted in for an hour and 15 minutes, and I have 3 hours of material. So bear with me. What I'm going to try to do is wrap up this talk in about half an hour and then go to questions and take it from there, and I'll be happy to stick around. I'm really looking forward to the party afterwards, so I'll be there too. Billy Shewcraft, back in 1974, I picked up an anti-war publication called WIN, published by Marty Geezer and some people, and there was this little article about Billy and her situation in Globe, Arizona. This was, you know, 5 years after the spraying, 2 years before her death. And so it was very serendipitous and fortunate because just as I'm finding out about this herbicide spraying where I live, you know, up where nothing can touch me and I'm just going to have a wonderful life before the apocalypse, here's Billy Shewcraft. And by then, she had written her book, which I have. And by the way, if you ever get the chance to actually meet an author, you should always buy their book. Billy's book is incredibly, what a cheap shot. Billy's book is incredibly special, and it's really unique. It was self-published. It's titled Sue the Bastards, and which is what they did. And there's purposely no index in the book. So if you're Edwin Johnson, Deputy Administrator of the EPA, or you're Dow Chemical or whoever, you know, you can't go right to the index. She said she wrote it that way with no index because she wanted the bastards to read the book. And we had great success thanks to Billy because she was pumping out the research. She was, you know, the real firebrand. And in 1974, we shut down the herbicide spraying in the Shawamigan and Nicolet National Forest, primarily because of her material and the fact that their environmental assessment was 2.5 pages long. And I spent that whole summer hitchhiking around northern Wisconsin, enlisting people in this campaign. We, you know, were packing hundreds of people into public hearings. I remember this one moment when this fellow who, Wayne Mann, I can't believe I grabbed that name, Wayne Mann, who was the head of the Shawamigan National Forest, came to Ashland, Wisconsin, where we had 300 people in a Catholic church basement, to hear the head of the Forest Service explain why spraying Agent Orange by helicopter was absolutely safe. And there were some great moments. One was watching him go through the slideshow and try to pronounce the word teratogenic. And then somebody said, "What's that mean, Wayne?" He didn't know that either. And then a really great moment was watching a local guy with a plane by the name of Manson get up and spill the beans and say, "Look, I worked in the Pacific Northwest spraying phenoxy herbicides in the Pacific Northwest, and I can't tell you how many tons of that poison we just dumped out there. We just ditched because our job was just to spray this stuff and put it somewhere." And he had this great definition of an expert that Sheldon wouldn't let me include in our book. But he was really passionate and really convincing. And he said to Wayne Mann, he said, "You know,